Artists, Development Wars, and Murder.
It's interesting to me that the sort of canaries down the mine shaft, so to speak, were artists coming into the community, because artists are so, you know, big personalities and rather difficult creatures to a certain extent. Maybe not the best first neighbor you ever want. I mean, that's a generalization, of course. I'm sure bankers don't fare much better than a lot of people's opinions, but that really interested me, that kind of odd off tension of artists being the ones that were sort of migrating to this place and disrupting the community.
That's Christopher Boland talking about his mystery novel, Orient. It's about what happens when conflicts over development erupt in a community on the far eastern end of Long Island, and several bodies turn up. Then we replay our 2014 interview with novelist Tana French about her murder mystery, The Secret Place. It's just been issued in paperback by Penguin. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Artists move in, and then the bankers and the hedge fund guys. And there goes the neighborhood. It's a phenomenon well known to the denizens of the Hamptons on Long Island's South Fork. Back in the 1950s and 60s, land outside the tiny enclaves of the wealthy was so cheap, even artists could live there. Folks like Jackson Pollock and Willem de Kooning. Their neighbors were farmers and fisherfolk. Then the artists became trendy and famous, and real estate values began their meteoric climb. Now even modest homes sell for $1 million or more. It's gotten so bad, the farmers and fisherfolk are being priced out of land and home. But until recently, the North Fork of Long Island remained as always, sleepy, undeveloped, and affordable. Then artists started moving out there too. The real estate frenzy followed, with tensions between locals and second homers close behind. My guest, Christopher Boland's book, Orient, works these tensions over development into a terrific tale of murder and intrigue. Written with a tip of the hat to Agatha Christie, Orient gives a deft portrait of a community in transition while spoofing the excesses of both the real estate and art markets. Christopher Boland regularly writes about art, literature, and culture. His first novel, Lightning People, was published in 2011. Orient was published by Harper in May of 2015. Boland is currently the editor-at-large at Interview Magazine. Well, Chris Boland, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
Orient is a murder mystery along the classic lines of an Agatha Christie novel, but it's set on the eastern tip of the North Fork of Long Island. Living on the South Fork, as I do, and visiting the North Fork, I found this a deft portrait of place. For listeners who aren't familiar with the region, give us a snapshot.
Well, the Orient is on the far North Fork of Long Island. It is the sort of northern brother to your South Fork. And as you know very well, the South Fork has been long a home for summer vacations, people from the city fleeing and going to the Hamptons and the beaches. And, there's also been a long tradition in the South Fork of artists, all the way from Jackson Pollock and Lee Krasner, Willem de Kooning. The North Fork is sort of a different beast, at least I think so. It's much more of a farming village and fishing land. I think that it's sort of long resisted the city migration that has, so much has been taken to the Hamptons, and very little seems to have gone to places like Orient. And that intrigued me, mostly because I myself seemed to have fallen into the North Fork transit. My friends who were artists were starting to buy houses in the North Fork, particularly in Orient. And that's sort of what first intrigued me to the place. Just the fact that there was a newness to it, and it hadn't really been written about that much. Nelson DeMille did Plum Island, and that was one book that was set out there. But for the most part, hasn't really received the same kind of literary fixation as certainly the South Fork has. I mean, Gore Vidal wrote murder mysteries set in the Hamptons. So that appealed to me. And I think you're absolutely right in the sense that what I was trying to do is create a place as the main character.
I think you did that really well. I mean, you hit all of the issues, and especially at a time of tremendous change. I mean, I remember when the North Fork was the Unhamptons, and as you say, it really wasn't that long ago. But it's really undergone quite a bit of change. When I've gone there, I see, you know, some of the mega mansions going up, and it's a change that's really at the heart and center of your book. One of the main issues, of course, is tensions between year-rounders and the weekenders and summer people, and the very connected wars over development in what's becoming a pretty explosive real estate market. Talk a little bit about that tension.
Well, I'm sure that, you know, my friends were part of that tension, and the sort of early pioneers. There had been artists going out to Orient long before the last decade, of course. Richard Serra has had a house there for a very long time. And I think he maybe chose it for a lot of the reasons that other artists chose it, which was that it was quieter. You could be hidden more. You didn't have to follow the sort of social parade that seems to, you know, infect the Hamptons and in a great way. But, you know, it was a quieter, more desolate, more anonymous place. And I think that when friends of mine started getting houses there, they started to sort of know each other and create a small community. And I think that, you know, one of the things that fascinated me was the way when suddenly that your real estate becomes more valuable, how it unsettles the settled, basically. You know, it changes all of the power dynamics in a community. There's positives, obviously, with more expensive land, your value goes up, but also some of the forces that kept the community together suddenly sort of disintegrate. And I think that was what I was seeing. I think maybe, you know, I think the job of a journalist is to go in and unwork the knots of a community and to try to figure out what's going on. I think the job of a fiction writer maybe is to tighten those knots and bring them out and the conflict out. So, you know, I don't know if it would resort to murder per se, although I'm sure it could. But yeah, there was a lot of tension there. And I think that Orient and the North Fork was used to being a much more smaller, family-oriented, agricultural and suburban sort of mix. And, you know, I think it's interesting to me that the sort of canaries down the mine shaft, so to speak, were artists coming into the community, because artists are so, you know, big personalities and rather difficult creatures to a certain extent. Maybe not the best first neighbor you ever want. I mean, that's a generalization, of course. I'm sure bankers don't fare much better in a lot of people's opinions. But that really interested me, that kind of odd off tension of artists being the ones that were sort of migrating to this place and disrupting the community. But yeah, I think that it's incredible to see just in the time of writing this book how much the North Fork has changed. I started it, and people kept asking me, the North Fork, I don't know where that is. You know, it was sort of an insider secret. And just within the first two years of writing the book, it became a destination unto itself. You know, the real estate prices just went skyrocket. And it almost felt like I was writing against time in a way, because it had become so well known. I was worried that the whole idea would sort of get lost in the shuffle, that it would seem like an old idea because it had already happened. But it was kind of amazing to write it in while it was happening. And now, you know, I can't afford to buy out in Orient. I don't know if I'd want to. They might be very angry at me, but I certainly can't afford the prices out there.
Yeah, at one point you talk about an estate that went for the unheard-of price of $6 million, and I had to chuckle, or I don't know, it was between a chuckle and a groan to myself, because in the paper here on the South Fork, there was featured a place, a property for sale for $55 million.
Yeah, I mean, the prices are still very different. There's a wide, between the sound, there is still a wide gulf between prices. But yes, I know, you couldn't write this book in the Hamptons anymore. It would make no sense. And I can't believe people pay. I have a friend, a wealthy friend. I myself am not wealthy, but who bought a house in the Hamptons for $28 million. And that just seems to me beyond comprehension. Any figure where you can never actually count it out, I don't trust or understand. But yeah, no, I think that, you know, that's the funny thing about Orion is I think that, you know, you could get a house there probably 10 years ago for $100,000. And now I get these updates because I've long been following the real estate out there. And they're, you know, small houses are $1 million to begin with. I'm sounding like one of the characters in my book, I realize now, complaining about everyone infiltrating and raising the prices.
But of course, you live in New York, which is not unrelated real estate market in many ways.
I could never buy a place here. I mean, you know, I rent an apartment, a one bedroom. It's a very nice size, and if I were to buy a place, I would have to downgrade to a studio, which, you know, there's a certain point where you don't feel like living like a college student just so you can own a little real estate.
Right.
But, you know, so I it was funny because I first started writing Orion. I had a whole other idea in mind for a book. I wanted to write a book set in Nicaragua that was going to be a family saga, you know, all this family returning for a weekend. And my agent told me, that sounds like the most boring idea in the world. So I quickly reassessed, and he said, like, you know, what's something more passionate or something closer at hand? And I was actually out in Orient finishing up the edits of my first novel, and I just thought, you know, this place is so interesting. And I think you brought up Agatha Christie. I think one of the things that I love particularly about Orient was that it was at the very tip of the North Fork. It's not one little hamlet and then 5 miles down the road is another little hamlet like the rest of the North Fork. It's really at the very end. It's almost like a dead end. And there's just a thin causeway connecting it to the rest of the island and the rest of America. And so instantly in my head, I did have that memory, because I was an Agatha Christie addict as a child, of reading those country manor murders where everyone's sort of isolated and shut off and forced to stay put. And so that really appealed to me, just in terms of the location, the geography, like the innate sense of how Orient sort of felt like a mystery in the making in itself. And it's spooky out there. I don't know how dark the Hamptons get at night, but Orient gets so dark at night, I find it extremely frightening.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Christopher Bolan about his mystery novel, Orient. It's about what happens when conflicts over development erupt on a community on the far eastern end of Long Island. You're saying that it's almost as if Orient is like one of those great English mansions where a whole bunch of people come together, and you really have a chance to develop the characters who are thrown together in close proximity, even if that proximity is just a geographic place. Start with the main character. Tell us a little bit about Mills, a 19-year-old man from California who spent his childhood in foster care.
That's right. Mills really appealed to me as a character. I think that, you know, there's a time after you write a book where you begin to psychoanalyze yourself and the book, and I was wondering if maybe Mills was some sort of subconscious development out of my own feeling of rootlessness. But I did like the idea of starting with a sort of mysterious character with no roots. He has no home whatsoever. He's 19, so he's a teenager. And I think that I felt like that was sort of the ultimate, where the artists are buying the homes and sort of feel like these radicals, someone who really has no family and no address and comes to a small town is actually the real outsider. That's the real radical in a way. You know, I mean, there's something very threatening about the stranger, obviously, and this is an old literary conceit. But, you know, and that interested me about Mills is his having this instantly loaded figure just for being anonymous or just being an outsider by his very birth. And one of the things, a lot of people will say, like, oh, I could never tell if Mills was good or bad or, you know, if he was, you know, what he was striving for all the time. And, you know, I actually did that on purpose. I worked really hard to make Mills sort of a semi-watery character. You weren't quite sure where you stood, not only because the murder mystery dictated or needed that, but also because I find that teenagers, I was trying to remember when I was 19, you know, we always portray teenagers as sort of young, nubile 40-year-olds. But But I recall being 19 and very confused, and every day I felt like I was a different person, and I could have joined a cult group one day or gone on a tour of a band or gone to law school. You know, you feel like you can do all these different things and be all these different people, and you're not quite rooted in even yourself as a place. So, but unfortunately, as we find out in the prologue of Orient, that Mills is sort of instantly cast as the possible killer by the town, sort of the easy target and the easy victim of the crime spree. And so a lot of the mystery is really how Mills is working to sort of create a home in Orient and stay there against all of the suspicion against him. And that was, that's a bit different. You, again, going back to Agatha Christie, I feel like I did sort of utilize the British idea of the old British golden age idea of the murder mystery rather than the American, because the American, and this is, again, a generalization, but American leans so much on the police procedural or the gumshoe detective, the cool detective. And I just didn't want to write a police procedural or involve a professional detective, because I find it's almost too easy, because you start with a murder, the detective comes in, and instantly he's solving crimes. And he has no real connection to the town. He doesn't really have anything to lose if he doesn't solve it, other than, maybe his reputation. But there's no sort of connection with the people he's interrogating. And so I wanted something where the de facto detectives had something to lose if they didn't solve it. And Mills has everything to lose. I mean, he could go to jail. He could lose his liberty. But, he also was trying to build a home and friends in this town. And he could, that's also something at stake for him.
And he's not alone. There are really two amateur sleuths. That's Beth, and she's also, I found, a very sympathetic character.
I loved writing Beth. She's, for me, the sort of, I think, every writer has a favorite character, a character that they lean on as sort of a second identity to themselves in some way. And Beth, to me, was really the heart of the book to a large degree. She's born in Orient. And she moved to New York City to start a career in the arts as a painter, and she kind of spectacularly failed as a painter. Meanwhile, she married a Romanian artist who was sort of a hotshot on the rise in the art world, and they decide to move back to Beth's childhood home because her mother was sort of pushed out by the community, but she's, moved to a condo nearby. And so they returned to Orient and under the idea that they would start a family. And so Beth gets out of the city and gets back to this setting away from all the noise and the damage of her not succeeding, and sort of realizes, it's kind of coming into her own too, much like Mills, like sort of realizing what she wants out of life and that maybe it wasn't what she thought she did. And, I think that's really something that all people who've lived in New York for a long time, you kind of become so, your identity becomes so connected to the city and what you do that when you step outside of it, it's almost like a shock of the self. Like you're not really sure what your identity is or what your goals are, or what you need. And it can be wonderful to leave the city and realize that. And also can be very frightening. I think Beth is in that place. She's unsure of what she wants. She doesn't know if she wants a family anymore. She regrets not continuing in the art world, but she feels already sort of her hands are tied with not being successful. And so, yeah, she finds herself quite lonely out there. It's weird to go home and, go back to your house and find no one home in a certain sense. And so she and Mills strike up a friendship because they are sort of two outsiders looking for a friend or a confidant.
This also provides an opportunity for you to, I think, do an a marvelous satire of the art market, of the art world. Just to leave the murder mystery plot for a moment, you have a very funny description on page 265. There are these other artists there. There's Luz and Nathan Crimp. And
right.
you describe some paintings, notable recent artworks by Nathan Crimp, which I think were really hilarious. Let's see, a white canvas boiler jumper. jumpsuit on which crimp stenciled plot summaries revealing the endings of popular books, films, and TV shows. It's called The Boiler Spoiler.
Right. That was sort of a warning, hoping that no one would spoil the end of Orient. But, you know, I had a really good time. I had been in the art world for a long time. Before I started writing fiction, I was pretty much an art writer. I wrote for Art Forum, and I still do periodically, but in a number of other places, reviews. And as I said, most of my friends are artists. So it was a territory I really knew, and I felt that the art world hasn't really received the appropriate treatment, the contemporary art world, in fiction. I feel like there's great, up until the 1990s, it works, and then somehow everything becomes a parody. And while there is so much to parody in the art world, I don't deny it, and there is a lot that I parody in the book, I also wanted these artists to be seen as sort of, you know, serious. Even Nathan, in a sort of comic man way of making work, he still, I think, takes the work seriously, or wants it to succeed as a serious piece, you know. And so I really wanted to inject that into the characters. I mean, they're obnoxious. They're very much deranged. I don't know if they're likable. I had a really good time writing them. Luz was a real treat for me to write because she is so opinionated, and it was fun to verbalize. It's sort of the opposite of Beth in that way. Beth is quite reserved, and Luz was just really go for it. And it's fun to have that character in the mix when you're writing. It really livens it up. But yeah, the art world, I think that, you know, that was an important part of the book. And I think that, you know, if you're just reading for the murder mystery, you might sometimes scratch your head and think, why is he going on about New York auction prices or Nathan's, you know, conceptual pieces? But, you know, to me, that was really what, not only what were the people that were coming into Orient, but an important part of why I wrote the book. I really wanted to present that side of what an artist is. And I think I found that it was much easier to do outside of the city. You know, to describe an artist working in New York City is sort of feels tired, and also you always have this idea, as soon as you describe a white cube of a gallery, it all starts to become sort of silly. But, you know, you take someone out into a different environment that you're not used to seeing them, and you can observe them better. It becomes less camouflaged. So I don't know. Did you find it? I'm curious. I want to do a poll. Did you find Luz Wilson to be a likable or dislikable character? Or did you...
No, just... not likable, but very enjoyable to read.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I enjoyed reading her probably as much as you enjoyed writing her. We're talking with Christopher Bolan about his mystery novel, Orient. One of the questions I had was, you know, there seemed to be a tension between, on the one hand, the idea of the artist as striving for, you know, real quality and integrity in his work, and on the other hand, selling out to what seems a really bizarre art market. I mean, more and more bizarre. I think there's Mills kind of expresses what a lot of us lay people think in looking at some of the art, which is, gee, I could do that a lot cheaper than what, you know.
Right. So, right. I mean, it still mystifies me, to be quite honest. And I don't want to call out friends, but, you know, it's this very strange phenomenon in the art world. And the more you think about it, the less it makes sense to a certain degree. I don't know why certain things cost so much money, and why there's a bubble in the market, and why it's sort of the Wild West of investment. But, you know, you start to think about art, and if it doesn't supply a function of seeing in a different way or adding some sort of psychological or cultural value, then it is really just toys for rich people that no one knows what to do with. And I think, you know, I think there's always that feeling with the art world and art that, you know, is this something of value? Is this meaningful? Is this just some sort of weird scam conducted by billionaires? Or, you know, and I understand very well Mills's speech on that, you know, how he doesn't understand why is this so valuable. And of course, he finds the meaning, I think, in saying, like, it provides really nice lives for you and your friends. And that is one way to think about it. But, you know, yeah, it's a funny thing. And it's amazing how much money is made off of speculation and development in the art world. You know, it's a form of real estate. Very much of the book is about real estate, but there's also a sort of real estate aspect to the art and the artists, you know, in the book.
And the two are connected because it's the artists. I mean, just as what happened on the South Fork here, I mean, you know, when my parents came out, my mother was an artist, a multimedia artist of the 70s and 80s. But, you know, land was cheap and it was much like the North Fork. And they weren't the only ones who, you know, because there were always the wealthy people who were in the other parts of town. But it was really the artists that did that, just as they did in Soho. So there's really seems to be a bizarre connection between artists and high finance.
Yes. I mean, it's always been connected by a golden thread. And it is really interesting. Of course, the great gentrifiers tend to be artists. They tend to go into the, you know, they can't afford their working, they need studio space, they need room to work, they need a cheap rent because they don't often have day jobs. They go into these areas and they create little communities, and then the communities become sort of bohemian and chic, and then, you know, that's there goes the neighborhood. So, yeah, I mean, it's amazing. I was just reading that, I'm confessing too much that I follow the prices of land, but I just saw that Andy Warhol's old sort of estate, little bungalow estate in the Hamptons is now selling for $85 million or something, something outrageous. And it's hard to fathom those kind of prices once again. But there is a clear connection between, you know, artists and money and artists and real estate and, you know, what they provide, I think, culturally to a place and why that becomes an enviable place to live. You know, and I think that's what maybe the people in Orient in the book who have lived there for generations or family, they sense that, I think. They sense that feeling that the artists are coming in and remaking the community as they like it, you know, while enjoying the fruits of what's already been there and been preserved, you know, the beauty of it. And that is a huge threat. I mean, that is a big threat. I imagine anyone living in Sunnyside is feeling the same way about artists coming into that neighborhood.
In Queens.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it works everywhere. You know, you start to see sort of privileged young white people mostly come into a community and you get scared for, you know, that you won't be there long. I imagine it's a terrible thing. In this case, it's, you know, Orient is also filled with semi-privileged white people, so it's a different relationship. But yeah, it's really an interesting topic, the idea of land and art.
Yeah, and so very much in this line, at the heart of the book, at the heart of Orient, your novel, Christopher Bolin, at the heart of this book is a controversy over a proposed plan of a local historical society to buy up the development rights of the properties that are sitting on the Long Island Sound. And I think this might be something that, you know, people who are not steeped in the culture of a place like the North Fork and the South Fork of Long Island might not understand. So explain to us, what does it mean? What does development rights mean? And why does this become such a critical fulcrum to the book?
Well, you know, it's funny because I was in Montana, and I was visiting a little bed and breakfast there, entirely unrelated to Orient. I was just there for a vacation of sorts. And the man who ran it was starting up a program to buy all of these cattle farms, these abandoned tracts of land for development, to buy the development rights from those who owned them. They weren't abandoned, but they were in disrepair, and the land in Montana was becoming more valuable. And so everyone was concerned that it was going to become these luxury places and so, or used, you know, for a zillion other reasons, I don't even know. And he wanted to buy up the development rights because he wanted to preserve the land. And that's actually something that's happened or proposed around New York and in places like the North Fork and in Orient. And the development rights is a funny thing. Is like you not only own the land you actually have your house on, the physical land, but you own sort of, you provisionally own what can be built on it. And you can also sell the rights, the future rights of what can be built on it, which I think is also really bizarre. So you can ensure, for example, that your 5 acres of land never becomes a Hilton or a hotel. It can never be used for commercial use. And so in the historical board in the book is very worried, maybe off, you know, because of this surge of New Yorkers coming to Orient and buying up land and buying the old houses and refixing them and doing massive renovations, that means that, you know, others are on their way. And also, you know, money is on its way, and it will soon become maybe similar to the Hamptons, where you get these mega mansions, and, you know, soon there'll be condos and Whole Foods restaurants, you know, where there was just a, you know, a little farm stand. And so they have hatched this idea to buy the development rights from their neighbors. So they're not owning the houses themselves, but they're owning the promise that nothing will ever be built there. And it's just an attempt, sort of maybe a desperate attempt, to preserve Orient, you know, for the future. And it does cause quite, you know, a problem with their neighbors, you know, with each other, because not everyone wants to sell those rights. And, you know, the funny thing is I did a lot of research on this, and there are so many legal provisions to ensure that there isn't commercial development in Orient. There's a lot of laws, and those laws can be changed. I mean, you know, you get someone else running the county, and they can, you know, they can change those laws. So the development rights is an attempt by the historical board to ensure that nothing would ever be built in Orient. That is a crucial part of the murder mystery.
Exactly. And what was also interesting is one of the characters in the book who is dead set against the idea of development rights is an old farmer. And, you know, I just want to quote something that he says in explaining it. He says, you know, this is an initiative that offered a few farmers down on their luck some hush money to sell off their development rights just so they could eat for another year and the whole time be robbed of what their land is worth.
Right.
You know, he's saying you're basically, you know, farmers who are having a hard time actually paying taxes unless they have an agricultural easement. You know, they're often, you know, if a farmer dies and the family wants to inherit, they can't afford to pay the taxes and they have to sell off the land to
exactly.
Big developers around here. And so he's really expressing, you know, I think a point that a lot of people may not get. I mean, a lot of people may say, well, development rights, that's a good thing.
And you'd think on the surface that farmers would be for it. Like,
exactly.
Hey, yeah, of course, like, That's preserving the land and keeping what it is, but, you know, but you're right. That's exactly what is, you know, it's funny that these sort of suburban characters who are part of the historical board, some of them, are proposing this, you know, benevolent way to save and preserve Orient when it was originally agricultural. And, you know, this old farmer has actually sort of been there, preserved hundreds of acres by growing corn and you know, he sees it as just another attempt to sort of create this beauty, this sort of beautiful postcard, meanwhile robbing him of, you know, what he's been sitting on the whole time. And all he has left, you know, as agriculture sort of dies as a way of living in, you know, so close to New York City. And I think I always thought that was, you know, really interesting. You sometimes are surprised by what you put together when you're writing a book. And I was interested in that relationship of the farmer to the development rights, because it seems like he would be supportive of it. He doesn't want it to become, you know, Radisson's or TGI Fridays. You know, he's, you know, part of the salt of the earth. But, you know, these are people struggling to survive, and they don't want to sell off their rights just for, you know, so they can eat for another year because their crop isn't selling. And and then what do they have, you know? Because it is a question of whether your the value of the land changes once you sell those rights off.
Right, exactly. Although there are ways, as I mentioned, that farmers can be supported so that the
right.
families can inherit as agricultural land and not pay the same kind of taxes. But anyway, this, you know, this was just some of the issues. I mean, there are others we haven't even mentioned, like Plum Island, which is
right.
another fascinating.
I will just briefly mention the reason that Plum Island intrigued me. Well, it's an intriguing place. It's an animal disease laboratory of the government, and it's just off the coast of Orient. It's its own Island. And I was early on in my research, I was being driven around by a former member of the actual Oyster Ponds Historical Board. And he said, oh, whatever you do, please don't include Plum Island in your book. We always get these people visiting Orient and asking all these questions about the animal disease laboratory. And I instantly wrote in my notebook, Plum Island? Because, you know, you shouldn't drop a sensational detail and then not expect the writer to use it. It was just too good not to, because it is really just sitting there.
Oh, yeah, there are people who claim, and I mean, there's been a whole book written, and I have to say it was convincing in certain ways. Plum Island was not just an animal disease laboratory, but also a germ warfare laboratory. And so there are those who say that the Lyme disease epidemic actually originated in Plum Island.
Exactly, exactly. There is a huge belief that it started in Plum Island, and then it went toward Connecticut, to Lyme, Connecticut, and that's where, which is nearby, and that's exactly where, you know, the outbreak happened. And I have for a long time ignored Lyme disease, but I have to say, much after finishing this book, I have become quite frightened of Lyme, and it's a terrifying disease. It sounds like apparently the ticks this summer are out of control. Are you finding that to be the case?
Oh, yes, but it's not just Lyme. There are a whole host of other diseases now that are coming in on the ticks that are just as bad, if not even worse than Lyme disease. So, yes, it's actually quite terrifying.
Maybe it'll be the insects in the end that own the land.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it really is a terrifying disease. So, I mean, you know, but that is true. There is a lot of conspiracy theory, too, about Plum Island and what's there and what was, you know, and that's why they are actually shutting it down. And there's been a lot of debate on whether it should be a park or it should be a contamination zone and not, you know, accessed by the public for decades, or if it should be sold to commercial developers. So, you know, that's just another aspect of what's changing out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it is a terrific read. It's called Orient. It's Christopher Boland's murder mystery novel. And I want to thank you, Christopher Boland, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Such a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You can read the first chapter of Orient by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we listen to my 2014 interview with Tana French about her murder mystery, The Secret Place. It's just been issued in paperback. Stay tuned after the break.
The Beast in Me is caged by frail and fragile bars, restless by day and by night, rants and rages at the stars. God help the beast in me. The beast in me has had to learn to live with pain and how to shelter from the rain.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Tana French's novel, The Secret Place, is the fifth book in her celebrated Dublin Murder Squad series. All are notable for their in-depth character development, plumbing the depths of the human heart to tease out what motivates us to do good and evil. That's an eternal theme. But French's novels also explore how contemporary forces shape individual lives. The Secret Place unfolds within a status-driven teenage culture in our hyper-connected digital age. An upper-class boy at an Irish prep school has been killed. And now, a year later, the unsolved mystery is reopened by a provocative message at the boys' sister school, a message that seems to come from one of the female students. The investigation brings to light a whole mess of power struggles between the girls at the school, between adults and kids, between the sexes, and between the detectives themselves. It's a fascinating read, and by the time the perpetrator is revealed, the reader has come to care about all the characters because they each contain the shifting patterns of light and dark that comprise our souls. Well, Tana French, welcome to Writer's Voice. The Secret Place is the fifth of your Dublin Murder Squad series, and it features a character from A Faithful Place, a previous novel, and that's Holly Mackey. Her dad also makes a minor appearance. In the previous book, she was a kid, and now she's a teenager boarding at the exclusive St. Kilda's School in Dublin. Tell us about Holly and how she begins the action rolling in this wonderful new book.
I liked writing Holly when I was writing Faithful Place. She was a 9-year-old then, and she was feisty, intelligent, devious, loving and loyal, and also very independent. And I thought that was an interesting combination of qualities and would probably make her into a very interesting person. But I didn't think at the time that I'd be coming back to her in any way. But when I started writing Secret Place, when I started thinking about it, I realized that this was going to be a book about teenagers, about their secrets, and I realized that Holly would be the perfect age to be that teenager, and that she would be actually, in plot terms as well, the perfect person to begin this, because it begins with Stephen Moran, who also showed up in Faithful Place, is in cold cases now and really wants his break to get onto the murder squad. And he gets it one day when Holly shows up in his office with a postcard that she's found on the Secret Place, which is the board, the secrets board, where girls in her school are allowed to pin up secrets anonymously, anything they want to reveal while still staying anonymous. And Holly has found a postcard on that board that has a photograph of a boy who was murdered on the school grounds a year ago, and the caption says, "I know who killed him." And she brings that postcard into Stephen, who now has to figure out what to do with it.
Yeah, and therein lies the tangled tale, which you tell marvelously. This is, there are two groups of girls in this exclusive school. Holly's group is four best friends, and another group who are enthralled to their leader. Two very different kinds of groups. They seem to each represent kind of an opposed stance to social expectations. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely. I'm very glad that comes through, because that's very much what I had in mind. To a large extent, this is a book about identity, about how you figure out who you are, which is, of course, central to being a teenager, and how you decide who you're going to allow to define you. Like, are you going to simply be defined by who you feel that you are? Are you going to let yourself be defined by your friends, by the authority figures, teachers and parents, by the media images of what you should be, by your peers? Who are you going to let make that decision? And the two groups of girls tend towards the opposite ends of the spectrum on that. Like, Holly's group are very intent on defining themselves, some of them more than others, whereas the other group, Joanne's, who are more kind of the standard idea of what mean teenage girls are like, they're very much defining themselves based on their received images, what they see expected of them, in everything from reality shows to glossy magazines to songs. They're taking on all these images and trying to turn themselves into what they're expected to be, or what they think they're expected to be. Whereas on the other end, Holly's lot want to decide for themselves who they are, and one in particular, Becca, has absolutely no time for what anyone's expectations of her are. She is going to be what she wants to be. And I'm not sure that either extreme is really healthy, because if you're allowing yourself to be entirely defined by society's projected expectations, then there's no there. You don't know who you are. If you were stranded on a desert island, if Joanne or one of her friends were stranded with no media input, she'd basically dissolve in a little puff of pink glittery fluff. You know, she doesn't know who she is without that input. Whereas on the other end, if you get back at the opposite extreme, who refuses to acknowledge any outside influence, that's not necessarily healthy either, because you do live within the world. You do need to interact with it and pay attention to the other people who you're living with, who you want to to share this world with. And I don't think either extreme is necessarily a good idea.
Yes, and you do this within, you know, very much within the context, as you say, of adolescent self-identity. And I just thought this was, you had it so spot on. I mean, not only the dialogue, which was amazing, and as well as the texting back and forth, which was, I mean, I learned an awful lot.
Yeah.
It's changed the way I text. But you also have this issue of identity come up in the other two main characters, which is Stephen Moran, who is the one of the detectives, and then the head detective in this case, Antoinette Conway. They're also struggling on both sides of this identity divide and social expectations.
Yes, very much so. And again, they're very polarized by it because Stephen is a people pleaser. He's quite malleable. He's very ready to be whatever people want him to be, whatever people expect him to be. And partly that's because he's very ambitious and he isn't what he wants to be. He's constantly hoping for the job or the person who will turn him into this elegant, erudite, effortless person who he dreams of being. And so he's very open to suggestion from outside, whereas Antoinette is the exact opposite. She is who she is, and she absolutely refuses to bend in any way to anybody else's expectations. Anyone who doesn't like what she is can get lost. And so they're not exactly the ideal pair at the outset. Neither one of them is particularly pleased to find themselves spending the day with the other.
And yet, in some ways, they are the ideal pair. I mean, it's so fascinating how the interrelationships unfold in this book with the girls also, but particularly in the intensity of the relationship of these two characters, the effect that they actually have on each other. Talk a little bit about that.
Yes, they do. Like I was saying, they start off not like being very much the antithesis of what the other one wants in any kind of partner. But gradually, not just through working together, but through the case, that changes. I mean, the case exposes them very intensely to how powerful a thing friendship can be. Stephen goes in there thinking that this elite private girls' boarding school, he loves it for its beauty, and he thinks that the beauty comes from the amount of money and age and things that have been poured into this school, and gradually realizes that it's nothing to do with that. The beauty that he sees in the girls' friendships comes from what they personally have put into it, for the amount of trust and the amount of risk and the willingness to sacrifice themselves for each other in very real and powerful ways that have been put into it. So the case changes him and his idea of who he is and how to define that. And in the same way, Antoinette, who goes into it really not liking this school at all because she sees it as an expression of a kind of elitism and worship of money and class that she's got absolutely zero time for. But by the end, she's seeing that the emotions that underlie this case, the passions and the love in many ways that underlie this case are not superficial and they're not shallow. They're very real things and they're very powerful. And so both of them are changed by this case. They don't just solve it. It changes them as well.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Tana French about her latest crime fiction novel, The Secret Place. It's the fifth in her Dublin Murder Squad series. And I wonder if you could also bring in now the theme of loyalty. You know, I think you really plumb the depths of loyalty as well as limits. And, you know, this is kind of a very personal echo of social expectations. It's the personal expectations that arise out of these relationships.
Yes, and these are, I think, some of the most intense relationships you ever form. Are teenage friendships, and they are life-defining because at that age you're figuring out who you are, and if you're figuring this out in tandem with your best friends, then who they see does define who you are at that moment in your life when those impressions last. And I think for all of these girls, these friendships become life-defining, and they start to measure who they are and assess who they are in terms of what they're willing to do for each other. And that question isn't just theoretical. By the end of the book, for all of them, that's become very strongly, a very concrete question with very high stakes. And all of them, in some way, betray the others. They're put in situations where, no matter what they do, they have to choose between one form of loyalty and another. And for each of them, that's a very hard choice.
Yeah. And there's a real sense of tragedy that I felt in this book. I mean, you lime these characters so beautifully. One really gets to care about them. And crime fiction, you know, obviously terrible, tragic things happen, but most of the time when one reads it, you don't have a sense of tragedy. If anything, you know, it's kind of a sense of fun. Who done it? But in this, there really is. Is that something that you felt as well as you were writing these characters?
Yes, very much so. That's kind of what interests me in crime fiction, isn't necessarily the puzzle of the murder or the gore element of the murder. I'm more interested in what would take somebody to the point of killing somebody else, and what are the implications of that? It's also why I don't usually have evil villains, because why an evil person does something evil, there's nothing mysterious about that. It's, you know, it's just because. But when you get somebody who is not evil, who feels compassion, feels love, and is not inherently cruel, has no desire to hurt anyone else, what would take them to the point where they feel that it's not just desirable but necessary to kill someone? And what would the implications be for them and everyone around them? I think there's no way for that to be anything other than devastating. And I also think if the victim becomes a real character, it's so easy for the victim to get eclipsed because, kind of by definition, they're dead for most of the book. So it's quite hard for them to become real. But if they do, and I had the opportunity because of the way I'd structured this book, where there's one timeline of the investigation through one day, but there's another timeline of the 18 months leading up to the murder from the girl's perspective. And that gave me an opportunity to bring the victim much more to life, and also to bring to life the possibility of a world in which they hadn't done it, to bring to life the possibility that how would things have gone if the murderer hadn't committed the crime. That, I think, that brings home the sadness of it, because you're much more aware that it isn't inevitable, that there are moments where this might not have happened, and that tragedy could have been averted.
Yeah, that was exactly my sense. You know, I had to reflect on that, which one usually doesn't in these in crime fiction. You know, that kind of brings me to the point. The victim is a boy. He's a teenager from the brother school of St. Kilda's, right across the road. You know, the teenage boys, they don't come off too well in this book, but he's a complex character and kind of indicates that there, if one had the opportunity, there might be more complex characters in more than just him or one or two of the other boys. Talk about the shaping of him, of this character.
Clearly, he's not getting as much space because of being dead for the present timeline. But Chris Harper is somebody who's having the exact same problems with defining himself as the girls are, because he's handsome, he's charismatic, he's popular, and everybody is projecting onto him what they expect a guy like that to be. They expect him to be kind of a Lothario. They expect him to be slightly dismissive of other people's feelings. They have all their expectations in place, and he's never had a chance to decide whether those actually fit who he is. And through the flashback timeline, he's trying to carve out a space in which he can experiment with different people that he could be and figure out who he actually is. And this is just as much of a problem for him as for the girls. And he doesn't necessarily do it in healthy ways, is trying to carve out a space to find out who he is. But he is trying to do it. He's not just some one-note heartthrob jock, mean guy, the way some people want to see him. It's just that people are projecting their expectations onto him, whatever those expectations may be.
Mm, yeah. Talk a little bit more about the structures. You say the investigation is over one day. Why did you choose that concentrated stage with which to write that part of the book?
For one thing, I liked the contrast with, I knew the girl story was going to have to arch over the entire time that encompassed the storyline, all the events leading up to the murder, and that would necessarily take months and months. And I wanted to have a very tight timeline to contrast. But also, I didn't want the detectives leaving that school once they were in it. I wanted it to be that once they were in that location, that tight bubble of kind of slightly cabin fevery, very isolated world, I didn't want them to be able to leave until they had found the solution to the mystery. If they leave, it dilutes that energy, it dilutes the power of that world, because they can escape, they can take a breather, they can come back fresh. They needed to stay in there, feeling that pressure tighten around them until they had an answer.
This book, The Secret Place, Tana French, seems to blend genres. I mean, it's a straight-up mystery, and that's the main focus of the book, but there are also elements of the supernatural, and I wondered why you put them into the mix.
Well, I like mysteries. That's what I like about the crime genre. I don't even care what kind. I like real, fictional, solved, unsolved. I love them all. I just love the sense of mystery, the sense that we don't necessarily know everything. And I think it's a very human trait. Human beings are much more interested in mystery than most animals. Like, if you offer an animal something mysterious, the animal will check, you know, can I eat it? Is it dangerous? No. Okay, I'll wander off. Whereas human beings are fascinated with mystery for its own sake. We put the amount of time and energy we put into mysteries that are unsolvable is unbelievable. And I love that. I've always loved mysteries. And for me, that was just an added dimension of mystery to the book. There's a mystery of who killed Chris Harper, but there are other mysteries. I like the points where the boundaries that we consider clear-cut start to turn a little bit blurry, a little bit permeable for the right person in the right time and place. And there are elements of the supernatural throughout the girl's storyline, but I was very careful to make it clear in the detective storyline, there's always a rational explanation for everything. It's not that the supernatural is taken for granted in the book as a whole. It is in the girl's storyline. Reading that, yes, that's absolutely what's happening. But when the detectives are in the detective storyline, there's nothing supernatural going on at all. There's like bad wiring and a hefty dose of teenage hysteria. And I wanted to leave it up to the reader to decide which of those is the actual case.
And yet the detectives are also perfectly willing to use the supernatural to get what the information they want to.
Oh, yeah, and I think probably you have to be as a detective, because what you're dealing with is so high stakes, and it's one of the things that fascinates me about detectives. They're dealing with life and death and truth and justice, and me, I have a bad day at work, and there are too many adjectives. If they have a bad day at work, somebody could die. And I think when you're in that situation, you have to be the kind of person who's very open to whatever comes to hand and very ready to use whatever comes to hand. And one of the things that does come to hand for the detectives in this book is this sense of boundaries being permeable, the sense of the girls being very willing to blur away from what we normally consider reality. And yeah, they're very willing to stir that up and see what pops out.
Tana French, A Secret Place is just out in paperback. I spoke with her in October of 2014. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.